Gordon Moore.
Well, good morning, Justice Gordon Moore. How are you today, sir?
Good morning, Rich. Doing well. Sounds like everything's fine down at KYMN this morning.
So far, so good. I mean, good. It's always a little chaotic on Monday mornings, but we got it all figured out, yeah.
No, great to hear about what's happening at Content, and yeah. Also always good to hear Tim McNiff. That's a highlight every morning.
He's great. We love Tim. When we last spoke, it was middle of October, and we were coming up on the election. We didn't talk about this. I don't know if you can actually answer this question or not. So refrain if you can't. But when there is an election coming up, and you've got colleagues that are on the ballot, is there any sense of? I mean, are people every other? Elected, I don't want to say politician because you guys aren't politicians, but every other elected official, the closer you get to election day, you get tense. You start to tighten up a little bit, and because you're just waiting to see. How does that affect the mood, or does it affect the mood in the Supreme Court chambers?
Well, that's a challenging question to answer.
Okay.
Very challenging. I will say this: I've got to be careful because. Under the Code of Judicial Conduct, judges really can't talk about judicial elections very much, which is a problem, frankly. But I will say that the House and Senate and people running for office in Washington and St. Paul are usually able to campaign when they are not in session.
Mm-hmm.
But that isn't the way the Supreme Court works. The Supreme Court calendar is sort of this... monolith that starts in September and goes right now at least through June. And so mm-hmm. we don't take 2 months off for right. an election break to allow, people who are running for office to campaign. We are moving forward with the same level of cases and the same work as we always do. And so for those who have the challenge of an election to campaign to run at the same time, that's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
We had a very challenging October with regard to cases, just hard cases, tough cases, interesting but challenging legal issues. And, I had two of my colleagues, Chief Justice Natalie Hudson and Associate Justice Carl Procaccini, were also running for office.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sort of this weird, thou shalt not talk about this
yes.
thing, large pink elephant sitting in the room staring at us all the time. We couldn't talk about it.
Yeah.
We couldn't attend their fundraisers. Obviously we could offer them some, moral support, but we couldn't offer financial support. We could not go publicly mm-hmm. and announce our positions on the race. And so it makes for a somewhat uncomfortable environment. I will say this, that both Justice Procaccini and Chief Justice Hudson handled that very, very professionally and very well. They never let their campaigns come into the work. It was never discussed in any way that was connected to our business. And we just go about doing our business.
Right, right.
And, they were both reelected. I'll talk briefly about judicial elections in a minute. But mm-hmm. it is a challenging thing. And, there are other states where Supreme Court elections have become highly politicized.
Right next door.
Yeah. Wisconsin is, and they run theirs on an off year. So mm-hmm. wait for the 2025 cycle. But I know there was a contested election in the state of North Carolina where my oldest son lives. And that is so close, it could be going to a recount.
Wow.
I mean, it is a hair's breadth between... In that state, the incumbent Democratic candidate and the challenger that's a Republican. Of course, in Minnesota, we don't have partisan labels like that, but that must make for a very difficult challenge when you are trying to do your job and you are having to campaign across the state in a high-dollar, high-stakes election.
Right.
And that turns judges into politicians, yep. which is what I think we are so concerned about. We are... supposed to be above that. We're nonpartisan. We are focused on the law, and bringing judges into the election space creates some tension with that.
Yeah.
What can judges talk about? I mean, there's the Code of Judicial Conduct is pretty strict about that, but there was a lawsuit a number of years ago that talked about free speech questions with regard to restraints on the comments that candidates could make. I will just say this. From my standpoint, our system has continued to work, but it's a topic of ongoing discussion as to whether or not our system is the best. I mean, different states do things differently, and there are some that have been pushing for a so-called retention election system where judges would not, people wouldn't be filing against a particular judge, but the judge would be up for retention, and a board would make a recommendation, and then the voters would vote whether or not to retain that judge or justice.
Okay.
And the problem with that model from a standpoint of judges is you're sort of running against perfection.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're sort of running against, you know, not, you know,
right.
Joe Blow, who's got all sorts of, you know, maybe his own issues, but you're running against this kind of model of perfection that we all strive to achieve, but few of us get there.
this justice had one gaffe at one point.
And retention elections have not been free of politics either. Iowa, a number of years ago, three justices lost their retention election because they had made a vote for marriage equality, which they knew fully well was likely to not be well received by some people, but they felt the Constitution and the law mandated it. All three lost their retention election. They were rewarded by the Kennedy Center with a Profile and Courage Award, but you know that's sort of a cold comfort consolation prize after you lose your job because you take a principled vote.
Right.
Arizona, not a dissimilar scenario going on down there with retention elections. So I am not convinced that the retention election model is the answer. We have had citizen participation in judicial elections since the creation of the state. I'm not suggesting we shouldn't, but I think we should look long and hard about whether our system is serving the interests of the voters. I will just say this on election day and the days up to it with the early in-person voting. My wife, in particular, heard from a number of friends, good friends, people who we consider to be well-informed, educated people, with just fundamental questions about who's on the ballot and who should they vote for. And it just makes me realize that the world I live in, that I'm so familiar with, is not a world that most people have much knowledge about. Right.
Both of my daughters, who never asked me for advice on anything, asked me about the judicial elections.
Yeah.
Like, just because they had no idea. And I said, well, this is what I know.
And if you live in Minneapolis or St. Paul, you've got, a page of names, most of whom are unchallenged, and voters, might reasonably wonder, why should I care about this? Or in, the third district, we talked about that, voters here in Rice County are voting for people in Winona or Albert, the Fremont County. And how do you know? I mean, unless you have a connection in the legal world or something, you don't know. Even people, even lawyers, you don't necessarily practice everywhere in your judicial district, so you may not have ever appeared in front of some of these judges, couldn't even give a recommendation. On election night, though, we did have 9 contested elections in the state of Minnesota, and all 9 incumbent justices and judges were successful. Chief Justice Natalie Hudson was reelected, or I guess it was her first term as Chief Justice. Mm-hmm. She's been elected before after being appointed by Governor Dayton. She received 64% of the vote to Stephen Emery's 36%.
That's pretty good.
The seat held by Justice Procaccini, he was elected with 57% of the vote to Matthew Hansen's 43%. Judge Diane Bradfield on the Court of Appeals defeated Jonathan Woolsey by 64-36%. And then in the state district courts, we had 2 judges in the second district in St. Paul. Timothy Carey and Timothy Mulrooney were both returned with 63% and 59% of the vote, respectively. Matt Frank, a new judge in Minneapolis in the fourth district, known to many as one of the prosecutors of Derek Chauvin when he was with the Attorney General's office. Matt Frank received 73% of the vote in that case. An open seat election in Duluth in the 6th District, Sean Reed won election there over Gunnar Johnson, 54 to 46%. And then in the closest race, this one was not necessarily on my radar, in the 7th District in Douglas County, Timothy Churchwell defeated a spirited challenge by Joel Novak, 51-49%. So that's pretty close. Yeah. That's, you know, of course, Douglas County is where Judge Churchwell is chambered, but the 7th District is an enormous district, starting in St. Cloud and going all the way up to Moorhead. So there's a lot of ground there. And then in the 10th District, Helen Brosnahan defeated Nathan Hansen, 56-44%. So the incumbents were returned. As we talked about when we visited about this last time, generally speaking, if there's a significant concern that the legal community has about an incumbent, competency, character, demeanor, you're going to hear about that. You're going to hear about that either because the Board of Judicial Standards is involved and there's been a public disciplinary action taken, or you're going to hear through the grapevine, through the filing of people that are considered to be serious challengers, that there's an issue here. Absent that, most judges are not challenged, and you know, we had a number of other judges elected that weren't on that list. So, yeah, we move on to the 2026 election, I guess, in judicial area. But I also wanted to talk just a little bit about, you know, what happens after the election.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of what do we do? Because I...
Can I ask you real quick before we get there? Just, again, the broad overview. And I should know this. So this is a little embarrassing. Does every state elect their judiciary?
No.
Okay.
Some states do not. Some states are like the federal government, where the judges are appointed and they are there for effectively life. Some states have mandatory retirement ages. Yep. I think Rhode Island might be that way, but most state courts are elected in some respect.
Okay. All right. That's all I needed to know. Thanks. So, so talk to us now that the election is over. What happens next?
Well, the results aren't official until they've reviewed and have been certified by a board called the Canvassing Board. I think you heard Logan maybe talk a little bit about this. Canvassing boards are the mechanism to certify the results of an election, and they can oversee a recount if a recount's necessary. So on election night, all the county election officials put their unofficial election results on the Secretary of State's website, and those are unofficial results that are reported by the press and by campaigns. But inevitably, there are small errors, typos, things like that that end up happening. And so the canvassing boards are there to clean up that stuff. The election officials proof the election results, and then the county canvassing board has to review and approve results before they're official. And they certify the votes cast within the county for races that go beyond county boundaries, and they certify the election results for offices up for election that are voted exclusively within that county, like county offices and legislative districts within a county. So the county canvassing board is comprised of the county auditor, the county administrator, the district court in that county, the mayor or chair of the town board of the most populous municipality of the county, and two members of the county board. Now, cities and school districts have a separate canvassing board that meets to certify their results. Mm-hmm. And so those canvas reports are sent to the Office of Secretary of State, where they review it, and then they incorporate it into what's called a statewide canvas report that's presented to the state canvassing board. And I am on the state canvassing board.
I am
one of them, yes. The state canvassing board meets following state elections to certify a state general election. It's comprised of 5 members. The Secretary of State serves as chair. And then to fill out the board, the Secretary appoints 2 members of the Supreme Court and 2 judges from the district court.
Okay.
And so obviously not people who are on the ballot.
Right.
And so Justice Hennessey and I are on the Supreme Court's representatives on the board this year because we had 3 members of our court that were on the on the ballot this year, and then a brand new member who I don't think had started at the time of the primary election. So the state canvassing board is responsible for canvassing and certifying the results of all statewide elections, including state and federal offices, constitutional amendment ballot questions, and state legislative and judicial offices that overlap more than one county. And so we review the compiled report from each of the 87 county canvassing reports, And if necessary, if a recount is necessary, we oversee a recount of results for that office. And so that happens later this week. Actually, okay. That's this Thursday. Those canvassing board date is set by law. Recounts happen occasionally. There's two types. There's publicly funded recounts and discretionary recounts. Publicly funded recounts for a federal office, state constitutional office, or judicial office can occur if the difference in the number of votes cast for the winning candidate and other candidates are less than 0.25%. Publicly funded recounts for a state legislative office may occur if the difference in the number of votes cast is less than 0.5%.
Okay.
There are two state house races right now that may or may not fall within that 0.5%. The one in Shakopee, I think, was an 18 voter that was definitely being recounted, is my understanding. The losing candidate does have to request a recount, and generally a race that's that close is going to get recounted. The St. Cloud area house seat, I think some other ballots had been added to the tallet that maybe pushed it outside the publicly funded recount requirement. But under the discretionary recount law, any candidate can request a discretionary recount. And, you know, if it's greater than the threshold for the publicly funded recount. And so that's on their expense. And those are pretty infrequent, because that's expensive. Mm-hmm. I was part of the Nobles County recount effort in 2008 with the Frank and Coleman Senate race that was really, really intense and interesting to see each of those ballots being counted in Little Nobles County one at a time.
Right.
And if there was any disputes over what the marking was, you know, they had to figure that out and make a decision on it.
I remember that recount taking months, too.
It took a long time, and it went to the Supreme Court. There was a special panel that was comprised, two members of the Supreme Court and other judges, and it was a thoroughly vetted election.
Yeah.
Very close. Very, very close. So we'll see what happens with the two races, two state house races that are potentially within recount territory, but there is a realistic scenario of a divided house, a tied house, 67-67, for the first time since 1979.
Would the court ever have to get involved in something like that? I mean, would there be anything that would trigger a decision to go to the Supreme Court on a divided house?
That would be unlikely.
Yeah.
I mean, what happened, as I understand it, in 1979, the parties met and figured out a power-sharing arrangement, and my understanding is there's been some discussions about that possibility happening now.
I hope those conversations are going
on. I hope so, too. Yeah. I don't think the court should be in the business of dictating to the legislature how they do their business.
No.
So that's the canvassing process and the recount process, and so we'll meet. The Secretary of State convenes our meeting. It's at the Judicial Center this Thursday afternoon, and we'll see what the Secretary has to say. It's an interesting process to be part of.
I'm sure. It's got to be fascinating. I'm an old poli-sci geek. I would love to get a bird's eye view of that.
Yeah, I would just say, from my perspective, it just reinforces the good work done by election officials in this state, from township and city and school district and county officials all the way up to our Secretary of State.
Yeah.
It's done, you know, in a nonpartisan way. There's one case that I did recently hear about an election judge in Hubbard County that was discussed. Yeah, yeah. That might be an arguable exception to what I just said.
Well, you might be hearing more about
that,
too.
We'll see. Yeah. You know, there's a presumption of innocence there, so I won't say more about that. But I would say that, from my standpoint, given my work with county election officials, they're doing good work, and it's a hard job.
Yeah.
The climate around elections has been tough over the past 4 years. And so hats off to the people that volunteer their time and are doing it as part of their job.
Absolutely.
At all levels.
Absolutely. With just a couple of minutes left, what is coming up for the court?
Well, we have a December calendar that starts on December 2nd, and it's a it's a quieter calendar. There's one notable case, though, that people might want to keep an eye on, and that's being argued on December 3rd, 2024. This is J.C. Cooper versus USA Powerlifting. And in this case, Cooper is a transgender powerlifter who was denied the opportunity, transgender woman who was denied the opportunity to participate in a powerlifting contest.
Interesting.
And there are really challenging questions about state human rights laws and how those apply to transgender people. I have not seen more amicus participation in a case since I've been for the court. And these amici are outside parties of interest that give us information about how we should decide the case. A lot of reading to do on that one. Let's just say that.
Sure.
So that one is coming before the court, and that will be interesting. The Court of Appeals ruled against the petitioner, and so the petitioner is asking us to take a look at that. We have a first degree murder post-conviction case, two discipline cases, and a couple of other more, you know, kind of in the weeds civil disputes that I don't think would be of necessarily general interest interested to the parties. But
yeah,
we are trying like heck to get all our cases done from last term. We had, you know, two members leave, and so the priority was getting their cases done, and so the rest of the court kind of had to wait in line a little bit. And it's challenging when you're picking up with new work in August, trying to get the old work done, and it's, you know, there's just a, I mean, the Supreme Court, it's, you know, measure 40 times, cut once, you know, I mean, that kind of analogy. And so it is scrutinizing detail that is employed to make sure that any opinion that goes out from our court has been thoroughly vetted. And it sometimes does make things move slowly, but there's a reason for that.
Right, right. Okay. Well, you're pressed for time.
I am.
And we'll let you go. Thank you so much for being here, Justice Moore.
Yeah,
we always love these conversations.
Well, thanks, Rich. It's great to be part of KYMN's team. And you know, I hope that we can bring a little understanding maybe to a world that a lot of people are really not part of, mostly happily not part of.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's important. Our third branch of government here is going to be called upon to get involved in a lot of complex things. And so I think it's important for people to understand a little about the legal system.
Yeah. Well, I always enjoy these conversations. I always get clarity out of them. And I'm a guy who kind of knows what's going on a little bit, but you always help me sort out the these legal details that I don't even begin to understand. So
thanks, Rich. We'll see you next month.
Okay. That's Justice Gordon Moore with Legal Talk. He will be back again on the third Monday of December. We thank you for listening, and we will now return you to our regularly scheduled, really good mix of music. Thanks, guys.
This has been Legal Talk with Minnesota Supreme Court Associate Justice Gordon Moore. If you have questions for Justice Moore or would like to suggest a topic for future conversations, email us at contact@kymnradio.net.